This is fun! The FU Network.
Hey, Canada. Welcome to episode 16 of Matter of Fact. I'm Ishat Reza.
And I'm Professor S. Let's get started.
Today, on Matter of Fact, we're going to be talking about the training of judges. And the reason for this is because the Liberal government just introduced a new bill that asks for judges to be trained regarding sexual assault. And this has caused a little bit of consternation among certain people who are lawyers and other people who are a little bit concerned about it. And so we're just going to talk about what exactly is being introduced, as well as how we got there. So, okay. Professor S., why don't you start with a bit of the history? Like, what gave rise to this legislation?
It really came out of a case in 2014, a federal judge in Alberta, Robin Camp. He was presiding over a sexual assault trial. And while the victim or complainant was testifying, the judge made a lot of comments which showed a complete lack of regard towards survivors or victims of sexual assault and context and whatnot. Some of the comments that were uttered,
lack of regard, but I think also just a lot of ignorance about sexual assault.
Yeah. And when we do, I've highlighted some of the more pertinent comments he made. We'll just see how bad it really got during that trial, whereby the judge asked the complainant, why didn't you just keep your knees together? You know, why didn't you scream loud enough while the alleged assault took place? And the one of the most disturbing comments was he looked at the complainant and stated, sex and pain sometimes go together. That's not necessarily a bad thing. So these are some of the comments.
Oh my God, I did not know about that.
No, you have to read. Oh. Like, the only reason actually I'm conversant with this case, because I use this as an example when we look at judicial behavior in the lecture hall. So this is something, there's a lot more, but that's the nature of the comments. Now, the defendant, Alexander Wagger, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, was acquitted by Justice Camp. And this part is another really disturbing element of the case, which led to this bill being introduced. He stated to the defendant, I want you to tell your friends, your male friends, that they have to be far more gentle with women, they have to be far more patient, and they have to be very careful to protect themselves. They have to be very careful.
Oh my.
And so in 2015, October of 2015, the Court of Appeal in Alberta struck down the decision. They ordered a retrial. And the court at that time stated that Camp did not seem to understand the laws on consent and alleged rape victim sexual activity. And here's the point that you were alluding to. The judge may have used sexual stereotypes and stereotypical myths, which has long since been discredited. So then in January 2017, the accused was acquitted in a retrial. And the presiding judge at that time found that the complainant was inconsistent and lacked credibility. That is the series of events that led to first the introduction of this bill, which initially was Bill 337 by then interim leader of the Conservative Party, Rona Ambrose, in February 2017. So it was introduced a month after the decision in the retrial. So that's just a brief history of what we've gone. Now, just to bring everybody.
And I think that case was very, extreme, right? I mean, it's sort of like, it's a good example just to show the extent to which some of the ignorance exists. But there are other cases too that have also given people who are either victims of sexual assault or just other observers from the outside, some pause in feeling confident that the judiciary understands the psychology around sexual assaults and so on, and you know, the whole idea of all these stereotypes and myths, and I mean, quite frankly, a lot of sexism, since women are disproportionately the victims of sexual assaults, and so there were other less extreme cases as well. And I know you've certainly looked at some of these
I have three, which I'll briefly touch on just so everybody can see bit of the range here. One comes out of the province of Quebec, Justice Bienvenu. This is the 1995 trial of Tracy Thaberge, who was charged with murder. She slit her husband's throat and let him bleed out on the kitchen floor. that the issue is not that. The issue is the comments made by Justice Bienvenu with respect to the accused. He stated that women who commit murder sink to depths to which even the vilest man could not sink. That's number one. Number two, even the Nazis did not eliminate millions of Jews in a painful and bloody manner. Number three, when he saw that a lawyer offered a tissue to a female juror that was crying, he stated Kleenex is a woman's best friend.
Oh my God.
And so that's...
Okay, and the reason why I guess the nexus with the sexual assault aspect here is that this person who is the lady who was accused of, mm-hmm. of the murder mm-hmm. Was repeatedly sexually assaulted by
right. There was it was an abusive relationship. And the judge was unrepentant, and he resigned in 1996. However, we then in 1999, I'll go through this one. Justice McClung, this was the Iwanchuk trial. And what did he state? Although the woman had initially said no to his sexual touching, because he had continued and she had failed to object further, this constituted implied consent. And the judge agreed. The judge argued that Iwanchuk's conduct was less criminal than hormonal. And so here we have another example of where we're saying boys will be boys and women ought to know better. That's ostensibly what we're getting out of this one. This resulted in a back and forth between Leroux Dubé and McClung with respect to promoting the stereotypes and myths of victim blaming, which is essentially what went on here. So that's another example that is used to show how judges are out of touch, to have blatant disregard for these situations. And the final one that I want to give you is from Nova Scotia, Justice Gregory Lenihan. His one line was, clearly a drunk can consent. So there was a female that was raped by allegedly raped by a cab driver in Nova Scotia. And the individual was acquitted in this trial. The individual was retrialed again and was acquitted. But the issue here was the issue of victim blaming. And this is a common thread that we find through these cases that touch upon sexual violence, female assault. We're seeing clearly that judges, not only are they, for lack of a better expression, uneducated on the history of sexual assault, which they all claim after they make these comments, but there's just a blatant disregard for victims' rights and understanding context, or as Rona Ambrose called it, the old boys club. Right? So that's where we are. And those are just some of the notable cases.
That's it. And so what I mean, I'll just add a bit of nuance there in that there are obviously enough judges in the judiciary who have displayed some ignorance and or disregard, et cetera, regarding the victims of sexual assault. But then, you know, that doesn't mean that they're all that way. The
correct.
Point with this legislation is the fact that there's enough there that gave rise to some concern from the outside. And what we're seeing is that of all the types of cases that are brought before the judiciary, when it comes to sexual assault cases, the victims are very rarely ever able to seek and achieve justice. And a lot of the reason for this is because there is this ignorance, the stereotypes, the myths around what constitutes appropriate behavior for victims of sexual assault.
Right.
So, for example, you know, even in the Gian Gomeshi case, you see that the fact that some of the victims still maintained contact with the alleged person who did the wrong was a reason to say, well, that doesn't make sense. Like, why, if this person had just, you know, assaulted you, why would you still be in touch with them? Why would you still take smiling pictures with them, et cetera, et cetera? And so
right.
there is a psychology around sexual assault that is different than what one would imagine if you were just to think purely rationally, right? And so there is some education that's required for not just judges, but I would say like people in the public and generally, you know, those in the law enforcement, et cetera, to understand that there is this psychology around sexual assaults that doesn't that's not intuitive. And so there is a need for this education. So that's kind of the backdrop here that, you know, is what prompted this legislation initially as a private member's bill. And then the Liberal government decided, yes, we'll take this on. So February 7th of this year, 2020, they did introduce Bill C-5, which amends the Judges Act. And what it says is that, you know, there's a requirement for those judges who are about to be appointed to take some seminars on this topic, and that so these judges should agree to participate in this kind of training. And so that's one part of the legislation. The other part is to say that the Canadian Judicial Council, and this is the self-regulating body that oversees judges and the discipline of judges and the training of judges, et cetera, that the CJC may require and establish seminars for continued education of existing judges along these lines. And if the CJC establishes these seminars must be developed after consultation with persons or groups that the CJC considers appropriate. So in that case, what they're not doing is they're not instructing the CJC that they must provide this. And the reason for that is because they're being careful about the idea of independence of the judiciary. Right. And this is something, a theme that's obviously been in the media, especially over the last year, post SNC-Lavalin case. And so the idea of sort of this independence from the legislature and government, et cetera. And so they're trying to get around it. Now, having said that, there are people who are lawyers and other commentators who are concerned by this legislation exactly for the reason that you're now telling judges what they should know or not know, and that's wrong. And because of this concept of the independence of the judiciary, which is so fundamental to the idea of the judiciary. Now, before we explore that a little bit further, I'll just give you a little bit more of what else is in these amendments to the Judges Act.
Okay.
What they're saying is that the CJC has to submit an annual report with details on what kind of training was offered and who, not who, but how many people attended the training, how many judges attended the training, and this report is to be tabled annually to Parliament. And there's also a criminal code amendment that judges are required to provide reasons for their decisions when it comes to sexual assault cases, because I guess in some cases they were not even providing a reason, and that, you know, was a problem. And the legislation says that the reason behind these changes is to improve public confidence and in the judiciary and to improve the confidence of sexual assault complainants in the judiciary. So clearly that was the driving force behind it, and to, you know, basically essentially tackle the idea of these myths and stereotypes around sexual assaults. So I'm just curious, Professor S, what's your take on this idea of the independence of the judiciary being compromised as a result of this legislation being introduced?
I think it's a bit of a red herring. Here's why. If you are to if you're going to have a trial on the issue of human rights, you expect your judge to be well-versed in human rights law, right? And to have an understanding of the issues at play and whatnot. So why is this any different? I don't understand why requiring judges to be aware of the social context settings in which this takes place is a violation of their independence. If anything, it's asking them to take in greater levels of context and evidence so that they can make a better decision. It's more data, right? That's in my estimation.
Yeah, it's education, exactly. Yeah. So I agree with that latter point, but what a number of people who are against this are saying is that, well, we don't dictate to judges other topics. Like, there's actually no legislation that says you need to be well-versed in human rights law. And then also another thing is, like, usually when you go before a judge, if there's expert testimony that needs to be presented so that the judge can understand, or the jury, the context better and so on, then the lawyers are responsible for bringing that forward during the trial. And so, you know, there is that aspect of it.
That's fair and well, but you also have a critical issue which people seem to dismiss, and that's changing prevailing attitudes, right? There's still this attitude in society that I run into this quite a lot, especially in the university setting, where if young women and young men have been a victim of an assault, sexual or otherwise, there's always, they feel like they're going to be judged by authority figures, whether it's police, society, parents, or the courts. It's just the way it is. And so what we fail critically is to empower these human beings to be in an environment where they believe that they will be treated fairly, right? That's the whole issue, equity. And so if you're going to continue with this process of allowing the old patriarchal masculine first stereotypes in society, you're going to have the same outcome. You're going to continue to have these types of decisions, these types of people making ludicrous comments, and you're not really going to create an environment in which survivors of sexual assault can come forward and say, this happened to me, and I want justice. That's not going to happen if you continue to allow the old mentality to prevail, and that's what I think is coming from the objections. And that's just my reading, right? I'm not saying everybody feels like that, but that's what I truly believe, that unless you're going to change the environment in which people are comfortable to bring this forward, it's not going to change. And that's, you know, from the ground up, you have to start somewhere.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, on this particular topic, it is one of, if not the main type of case that goes before judges that seems to repeatedly fail the victims. And, you know, not saying that there aren't other systemic issues that, you know, would need to be addressed as well, but this is definitely one that stands out. And I think just given the history and especially some of the high profile nature of the case of the judge out of Alberta, that's kind of what got the politicians to take this on. And so on. And you know, just to say, like, the CJC did, in the case of the Alberta judge, do an inquiry into it. Obviously, someone would have had to complain. They responded, right? Yep. And they did find that, you know, his behavior really did hurt the public's confidence in the judiciary. That was completely unacceptable for a judge. And so they recommended to Parliament that he be removed as a judge, which is really quite extreme. I mean, it's very rare that anything like that has ever happened. I don't think there's actually even been a case that has made it all the way to Parliament actually removing a judge. Usually along the way, a judge will resign if they're, you know, seeing that things aren't really going their way, or they'll come to some kind of agreement, like they'll retire early and, you know, whatever.
You're right.
Yeah. So in this case, this judge is no longer a judge. And he resigned before he was actually forcibly removed.
The funny part is he resigned the same day the CJC recommended that Parliament remove him. So that report came out and he quit that day. It was in March of 2017 when that happened.
Right. Well, I mean, he knew that, you know, Parliament was going to remove him, so he'd rather just resign. And there may have been some pension implications, I'm not sure. But in any event, so they did deal with him, but I guess the issue is that there still is a sense that and facts that or statistics that victims of sexual assault are not getting justice. And so having this education, the idea is hopefully it'll even the playing field for all of those you know, who are involved in a sexual assault trial, so that it's fairer and it's a better environment for the victim to seek justice. And again, like I said, you know, there are a number of people who are against this because of the idea of, you know, basically infringing on the judiciary's independence, etc. But you know, the reality is that the Judges Act, which is an act of Parliament, does set out a number of criteria that basically says these are the people who are competent to be judges. These are the criteria for eligibility. You know, they talk about, well, this is, you know, about salaries, allowances, and sort of, you know, their remuneration, absences, retirement, et cetera. So there are all these things that are governed by what Parliament has instructed.
Right.
And so to me, this is in a way like an extension of saying, well, this is also part of the eligibility criteria to be a judge, is that you have to be educated in this particular area of law because we think it's necessary for you to do your job well. And for there to be confidence in the judiciary. So, you know, there is that. But having said that, I had a very intelligent discussion with a friend of mine who's a lawyer, who is usually very progressive and very sensitive to these issues. And he even said, he's like, if the Parliament felt that they needed to make these changes, why didn't they just amend the criminal code and build right into that, you know,
interesting question,
that certain types of behavior will not be used against the victim and that sort of thing. And
they've
so that's,
certainly,
you know,
done that in the past. There are cases, Seaboyer and Gamay, where they address section, I think, 276 or 278 of the criminal code some time ago, where we were looking into the ability of defense to use a complainant's sexual history and
exactly.
how judges can use that information. So they have done that.
And this time they do it too. They make a criminal code amendment about, you know, how judges are required to provide reasons
right.
for their decisions. So they did do it a bit. So presumably they thought about it. I do agree that that could have been another way of doing it. But if the effect is the same, then I'm not sure, you know, how that is any different. I mean, essentially, it's just using a different mechanism. And I think also the difficulty with the criminal code amendments is that, well, then you have to anticipate what are all the potential stereotypes and myths that a judge, like, it's kind of a negative approach, right? And then sort of striking them off and saying, well, they can't think of this and they can't take that into consideration, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas, like, when you provide education, it's sort of a more positive way of doing it and actually changing attitudes and that
sort
of thing.
It also covers a lot more externalities as well when you take that approach for education rather than delineating.
Yeah, and I think the way that they've set it up, especially for, you know, what it says about the CJC, that mm-hmm. you know, the requirement is that, well, you got to develop your training in consultation with people that you consider appropriate. So it's actually respecting their independence and saying that, look, you guys figure it out, mm-hmm. but there is clearly an issue, and we'd like for you to figure it out. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not too fussed about the way in which they've gone about it. Having said that, I recognize that there's, you know, some concern around it. But mm-hmm. I do think that it's a worthwhile piece of legislation, and I hope it will go forward and become law. The last time it was tabled, it died because the election came up. It died in the Senate, and so this time, hopefully, it will not.
It died because the Senate put it at the bottom of its priority list. That's why it died, right? To be blunt about it. I mean, it was a private member's bill from Rona Ambrose, and they took over a year to even get to it when it was going through the process in the Senate. So, and that raised a lot of bitterness, where Rona Ambrose herself just called it the old boys club, holding up progress in the legal system. So
I think it was also specifically, she did call out her colleagues, her conservative colleagues.
She did. She absolutely
so that's the thing.
Did.
I think there were some proponents within the Senate who really wanted to move this forward, mm-hmm. but then it was the conservatives within the Senate that didn't. And so she did call them out on that.
She did.
Which is good for her. So hopefully this time, you know, there won't be politicking going around. And I mean, you know, if it does become law, I would be very surprised if anyone would have the gall to challenge the law as being, you know, unconstitutional, because it infringes on judicial independence. Because essentially then what you're saying is on this particular issue that, you know, you don't think it should be, you know, it's just the optics around it of saying that we're going to fight this, that we don't want judges to be educated on sexual assault. You know, like, it just, I think it would just be bad PR if anyone does challenge it.
As somebody who has interacted with many students who have thought about going to the police due to being sexually assaulted and ultimately not going through with it, their big fear is authorities won't believe them, or they will doubt them, or they won't take them seriously. So
yeah.
If you're going to oppose this type of legislation, that's what you're ultimately doing, creating an environment where people feel more scared, more afraid to speak out for something they've experienced. So that's just, I would ask people to take that into consideration when you start worrying about, you know, are we infringing upon judges' independence by asking them to become educated
Right, exactly. Like, you're not telling them how to rule and how to.
No, you're absolutely not.
You know, you're just helping them understand the psychology around sexual assault and something that's, you know, very widely misunderstood in society. So so stay tuned. I guess we'll see how it goes. How about we move to the fails of the week?
Okay.
I'll start with a media fail.
Go for it.
So my media fail is the coverage of the Wet Sweatin protests. In that, you know, obviously there's a lot that's been going on. It's a very complex issue, but I do think that there has been a deficiency among many in the media in covering all various aspects. And so in our last episode, you know, we did talk about some of the energy files and
yes,
we touched on the protests. But what was clear is that, you know, understanding the complexities from the perspective of the indigenous communities is not something that's been properly reported, right? So they're
horribly
not educating. They're not educating the public on you know, the fact that there is a diversity of opinion among those in different indigenous communities around these issues, and then also more details on, like, well, who specifically are these protesters, you know, and kind of like, what is it that they're asking for? There's sort of the immediate stuff and context, but then there's a long history as well. And so I think, you know, looking at this particular issue, I think there are a lot of sensitivities that really has not been properly covered. And essentially the narrative that is coming out after report is that, well, the federal government, it's all their fault. They're not doing enough. It's all Trudeau's fault. He was off in Africa. He didn't care what was going on. You know, like, it's just this really caricaturized way of depicting what's been going on, when really it's not a complex issue, because there's been multiple levels of government involved. There's a long history. We're talking about you know, concerns of certain indigenous communities and people within certain communities, partly and not everybody, and that sort of thing. And so there's just been, I think, you know, the easy go-to, which is, well, the federal government is inadequate, and that they're not doing enough, and, you know, that now blockades must come down. But only 5 days ago, they're like, no, we need to negotiate this. And, you know, my thought is, well, obviously, you start from a position of, let's try to dialogue. You try to make it happen. If that doesn't happen, then yes, you go and say, okay, now, you know, we think the blockade should come down, and sort of implying, well, you know, hopefully police and law enforcement will do their job and do that and so on. So I don't know. I just feel like that has been a very poorly covered issue. There's been a lot of coverage, but it's just not been comprehensive.
There's so much information that the media skims over when it comes to reporting the actual complexities of the issue. That much is clear. We had this discussion in my environmental governance seminar last night, and one of the great problems that, you know, these students found was, we're not being told the full story. We feel like the story is incomplete. We're not being told who the relevant actors are in this.
Exactly.
We're not being told, well, what is the provincial position in all of this as well?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, it just seems to be a lot of muckraking and muck throwing at the federal government. Regardless of what you think of the current government, the prime minister, it just seems to be a bit of an imbalance in terms of coverage and blaming and whatnot.
Yeah. And that's it. There's a blaming attitude behind the coverage. And it's just like, that's not their job. Their job is to report on, you know, what's happening, give us all the various perspectives and so on. And then, you know, you get the Bob Fife, who gets on some commentating show, and his opinion was that, well, the prime minister is just weak. The prime minister is just weak, you know. And it's like, okay, let's you know, you keep your conclusions to yourself. Let's just, you know, report the facts to us, right? Let us draw those conclusions ourselves.
Speaking of facts. Well, do you want to move on to the political fail?
Yeah.
I have some factual. All right, so the political fail. The Premier of Alberta, Jason Kenney, is my political fail for this week.
He's gloating right now.
He can gloat. Yes, he's gloating right now over the Alberta Court of Appeals decision that the carbon tax violates the division of powers, Section 91-92 of the Constitution. That's another issue.
Yeah.
I'm not going to focus on that, because that's ongoing litigation. What I want to talk about is the decision of Teck. And what Teck just chose to do. So, if you read Teck's statement, and why it pulled out and why it's taking a charge of $1.13 billion of winding down its oil sands project. It centers on the uncertainty and instability over climate regulation in not only the province, but the country, right? It quite clearly says it's unstable. Jason Kenney is blaming the federal government for Teck's decision. But if you take a look at the historical timeline of what's happened with respect to regulation, the uncertainty and instability only happened when the government of Alberta withdrew from cap and trade, which was the policy paradigm under which Teck decided to invest in the oil sands, right? So this decision was made during then. So Jason Kenney is looking at factual data, looking at empirical evidence, and just disregarding it. I'm blaming the federal government for Teck walking away when you can't do that. There's nothing, there's no proof to suggest that. So here we are, you know, a government stating that tens of thousands of jobs are being lost. You have Daniel Smith saying the suicide rate is going up in Alberta because the federal government isn't allowing oil and gas to expand its economic footprint to create jobs. You have all of this horrific lying going on. But the actual truth is, Teck, the people who are taking the hit, are stating the laws aren't certain. We can't invest in such an environment. And so for that reason alone, Jason Kenney, not that he's going to, but he needs to take his blame for what is just gross mismanagement. It really is. When you pull out of an agreement such as cap and trade purely out of political and partisan concerns like we did in Ontario, and you don't consider the unintended consequences of your actions. And because of that, you blame others, right? It's the oldest trick in the book. And now we're going on this game of blaming the rest of the country for Alberta's woes. Yeah, it sucks, but it's not the rest of the country's fault that Teck pulled out because the government of Alberta pulled out of cap and trade.
And that's it. Like, it's a business decision that was made, right?
Sure.
Like, and that they, you know, put out that thoughtful letter explaining a lot of different things and acknowledging that, you know, the environment is changing and that, you know, there needs to be some clarity, I guess, around the rules of the game, taking into account the fact that the environment is changing. And so, I think that's right. I think Jason Kenney and company, I would say, are now going to blame, you know, the federal government for a business decision that was made by a private company.
But the last point, just to tie it off, is they're not even acknowledging that the price of this commodity has fallen to such a low that it doesn't even make sense for Teck. They're not even regarding that in their narrative. So for that, it's the fail. Anyway.
Exactly. No, that's good. Okay, so any fact or fiction?
I have one for you. In line with our topic. So we talked about the Canadian Judicial Council, right? It was established in 1971. And so here's a fact or fiction for you. Prior to the establishment of the Canadian Judicial Council in 1971, there were five petitions for the removal of federally appointed judges. All five judges were removed. Fact or fiction?
I think that's fiction.
You're 100% correct. It is fiction. All five resigned prior to Parliament convening in a joint session to vote them out. So, all five removed. They did not want the notoriety of being removed from their post by a joint sitting of Parliament, which is what it would take for them to be removed. So that just goes to show how infrequent such removals are as well, right?
Absolutely. Or even cases against, like, I mean, the inquiries and so on, they're very few. You could probably count them on your hands and toes.
Quite easily.
Yeah. Okay, well, that was good. So next time on Matter of Fact, we're going to be talking about the medical assistance in dying legislation, and then the new legislation the amendments that are going to be discussed in the near future. That will be our topic for next time. In the meantime, have a good week, and we'll be back in short order.
This is fun. The FU Network.